The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and probably also from the Harvard Heart Letter. And in fact, the first article that I'm going to read is from the Harvard Health Letter, and we're completing the September 2022 issue. This one's entitled Navigating Doctor Speak. Medical jargon is a necessity among professionals, but it can be confusing for the rest of us. Here's how to handle it. Doctors have a language all their own. They use terms like lipid profile for a test measuring cholesterol and other fats in the blood, and dysplasia for abnormal cells that can turn cancerous. While doctors typically translate medical jargon into patient-friendly terms, they can slip. And if you don't understand what your doctor is saying, it may lead to problems when you get home. What if you don't understand a medication regimen or a follow-up instruction? Evidence shows communication gaps between providers and patients affect health outcomes, says Vishwanath, the Lee Kum Kee Professor of Health Communication in the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Why use jargon? Doctors around the world use standardized medical terms for a common frame of reference, regardless of their native language. They're using technical terms so all physicians are on the same page, Vishwanath says. And as medical science advances, doctors must be as specific as possible. The treatment of choice may depend on it. For example, breast cancer that's hormone receptor positive and needs estrogen or progesterone to grow would require certain treatments to lower hormone levels. But those wouldn't help hormone receptor negative cancer. You may be uncomfortable asking your doctor to explain medical information. Perhaps you feel embarrassed or intimidated, or it's just too much when you're sick or stressed. Maybe you have cognitive decline or hearing problems, or there could be cultural differences that affect your interpretation of certain terms. These are all understandable. However, it's in your best interest and the doctor's to make sure you have the most positive health outcome possible. And that depends on good communication. Consider the following approach. Prepare in advance. Write a list of questions to ask during the appointment and bring it with you. Tell the doctor about the list at the start of the visit so the doctor can leave time for questions. Evidence shows that patients who go to a doctor's appointment prepared with questions leave with greater satisfaction than those who don't, Vishwanath says. Speak up. Stop the doctor if you hear something you don't understand. It's okay to ask, when you say this, what do you mean? The doctor has a duty to help you, Vishwanath says. Bring a friend or family member. A buddy can act as a second set of ears, ask questions you may not think of, and write down important information. Repeat the advice. Tell the doctor what you heard. Ask if you got it right. If not, have the doctor explain it again. Be firm. You don't have to learn to speak the language, but it will help if you resolve to become a skilled advocate for yourself. And the article goes on to mention a few medical terms that are commonly used in doctor's offices, and I'll give a few examples. For example, atherosclerosis, which means narrowing of the arteries caused by the buildup of fatty deposits called plaque. Biopsy, which means a procedure to remove a small amount of tissue for examination in a laboratory to diagnose disease. Body mass index, a calculation that uses your height and weight to estimate your body fat level. hemorrhagic stroke, bleeding in the brain caused by leaking or burst blood vessel that interferes with brain function. Ischemic stroke, a blockage of blood flow to the brain typically caused by a blood clot that interferes with brain function. And finally, myocardial infarction, which means a disruption of blood flow that kills part of the heart and also is called a heart attack. Now, continuing with the Harvard Health Letter, I'm going to go to an article entitled Fall Vaccination Roundup. Even if you're exhausted from pandemic-related vaccinations, it's still important to stay up to date on all of your shots. As the COVID-19 pandemic drags on with vaccination requiring boosters, it can be easy to forget about vaccines that guard against other illnesses. But vaccines are more important than ever as the years pass. Your immune system weakens with age. You can't fight off infections as well as you used to, says Dr. Suzanne Salomon, Associate Chief of Gerontology at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. If you have medical conditions, they can make you even more vulnerable, so any vaccinations are helpful. Talk to your doctor about whether you're up to date on vaccinations and boosters for COVID-19, tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, hepatitis A, as well as the following illnesses. And the first illness that's discussed is influenza. The CDC suggests getting your annual flu shot in September or October, but Dr. Salomon says it's better to wait until November. The flu shot loses 7% of its effectiveness every month, but flu season doesn't arrive until December or January. So my warning is that you shouldn't get the shot too early. If the flu season begins unusually early, then you should get the shot sooner. There are a few types of flu shots, and Dr. Salomon advises getting whatever flu vaccine is readily available to you. But if there's a choice, the latest recommendation for people 65 or older is to go with the high-dose flu shot over the regular dose. The high dose is 4 times stronger than the regular dose, and people 65 or older need more of a boost to get immunity. People with heart, lung, or kidney disease are especially susceptible to flu complications. So are people who take medications that suppress the immune system. The flu shot may help reduce your risks, including the risk of heart disease from the flu. The next vaccination that's discussed is shingles. If you're 50 or older, you need 2 doses of the shingles vaccine, which is called Shingrix, 2 to 6 months apart. Shingrix, which is spelled Shingrix, protects you against reawakening of the varicella-zoster virus, which lies dormant in your nervous system after a case of chickenpox. The virus can emerge years later, causing a painful rash known as shingles. Even after the rash clears up, pain can last for years. Getting the shingles vaccine not only protects you against a shingles outbreak, it also reduces your risk of debilitating chronic pain. The shots offer 90% protection for at least 7 years. However, the shots can cause temporary symptoms. The shingles vaccine can cause 2 or 3 days of flu-like symptoms, like muscle pain, fatigue, and redness at the injection site, Dr. Salomon says. But after all the patients I've seen suffer from shingles and post-shingles pain, I tell my patients the side effects of the vaccine are worth it. You may hear that you don't need to get the Shingrix vaccine if you've had the shingles. If you don't remember ever having chickenpox, or if you had an older version of the shingles shot called Zostavax, none of that is true. In other words, if you've had an older version of the shingles shot, Or if you don't remember ever having chickenpox, you should still get the Shingrix vaccine. And finally, pneumonia. The pneumococcus bacteria can cause pneumonia, meningitis, and blood infection. You are protected from this by pneumococcal vaccine. Recommendations for these shots have changed a few times in the past decade, and they changed again this year with the FDA approval of two new vaccines, one called PCV15 and one called PCV20. These new vaccines are now the preferred vaccines rather than PCV13, which was called Prevnar 13, and PPSV23, which was called Pneumovax 23. The CDC now recommends that people age 65 or older, as well as adults younger than 65 who are at high risk for pneumococcal vaccine, get either a single dose of PCV20 or Prevnar 20, or a dose of PVC15, which is also called Vaxneuvance, followed by a dose of PPSV23, which was called Pneumovax. If you already got the PPSV23, you should get one of the new vaccines, the PCV15 or the PCV20, 1 year later. If you already received PVC13, which is the Prevnar, you should have gotten a chaser of PPSV23 a year later. If you didn't, the CDC says you should get it now. You don't need the new vaccines. It's very confusing, so get a record of the vaccines you receive from your primary care doctor, Dr. Salomon says. Keep the information in a notebook, on your smartphone, or on your computer, and keep your primary care doctor up to date on any vaccines you may receive from any other doctor. And finally, from the Harvard Health Letter of September 2022, is an article entitled Getting Stuck in Long-Term Grief. Prolonged grief disorder is now a recognized mental health condition. When a loved one passed away, we each grieve differently and on our own timeline. When an intense level of grief lasts beyond a year, experts now have an official diagnosis for it. In March 2022, the American Psychiatric Association added prolonged grief disorder to its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is called DSM-5. The guide clinicians use to diagnose mental health conditions. Prolonged grief isn't just missing your loved one at 12 months. It's debilitating and interferes with functioning. It exceeds social, cultural, and religious norms, says Sue Morris, a senior psychologist who specializes in bereavement at Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Prolonged grief disorder applies only to people mourning the death of a loved one. The condition is estimated to affect 7 to 10% of bereaved adults. Symptoms are very specific. After 12 months, a person with prolonged grief still has a daily, intense longing or yearning for the loved one, or remains preoccupied with thoughts and memories of the loved one to the point that it interferes with daily life. To be diagnosed with prolonged grief, a person must also have at least 3 of the following symptoms. A feeling that part of oneself has died. Disbelief about the death. Avoidance of reminders that the person is gone. Intense anger, bitterness, or sorrow related to the death. Difficulty re-engaging with life. Emotional numbness, especially regarding connection with others. A feeling that life is now meaningless, and intense loneliness due to the death. In addition, the symptom must not be better explained by other conditions like depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, or substance abuse. There's a number of reasons why the cloud of grief can envelop us and keep us wandering aimlessly in another world. The risk factors fall into two categories. First, there are circumstances related to the death, including trauma, suddenness or violence, lack of preparation for the death, death of a child or a younger person, or death in a hospital intensive care unit. Secondly, there are circumstances related to the bereaved individual, including a history of psychological disorders, like depression or substance abuse, other losses in life, or lack of social support. Having a close or dependent relationship with the person who died is another risk factor for prolonged grief, especially for people who've been married for many years. They grew up with their spouse and often relied on each other for companionship in doing certain jobs. When one dies, the other has to navigate a lot of change, and that can be very hard, especially if they are isolated or struggling with other issues, Morris says. Those risk factors can derail the normal grieving process. That's why prevention is important. We want to get ahead of that curve. When I meet family members soon after someone dies, I try to identify known risk factors and what we can do now to help. Health consequences. Left untreated, prolonged grief disorder can lead to health problems. Any kind of grief can contribute to chronic stress, inactivity, missed doctor's appointments, increased blood pressure, which raises the risk of stroke, high cholesterol levels, which raise the risk of heart disease, high blood sugar, which raises the risk of diabetes, alcohol or drug abuse, insomnia, and a weakened immune system. Prolonged grief disorder, in particular, increases the risk for a shortened lifespan or for suicide. Dealing with grief starts with self-care, giving yourself permission to grieve, and following healthy lifestyle habits, even if it's just eating one healthy meal a day or going for a brief walk every day. Connecting with friends and family is also important. Also, you should make a visit to your primary care doctor and be assessed by a therapist. If the therapist determines that you do have prolonged grief disorder, healing is possible. Having this diagnosis can validate someone's experience and help the person receive the appropriate treatment. We have evidence-based therapy programs which help people understand grief, manage painful emotions, deal with avoidance, think about the future, tell the story of the death, and learn to live with reminders, Morris says. In time, they reintegrate with life. For more information on coping with grief, check out the Harvard Special Health Report, Grief and Loss. And that can be found at www.health.harvard.edu/grief. And now we're going to turn to the Harvard Heart Letter. And I'm going to start with an article called Ask the Doctor with Dr. Deepak L. Bhatt. He's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. Question. I've had high triglyceride levels, 250 to 280, for years. Because I take a statin to lower my cholesterol, I thought I didn't need to worry. Is that true? I'm trying to follow a healthy diet, but is there anything else I should do to lower my triglycerides? And Dr. Bhatt answers, triglycerides, the most common type of fat in the body, come from fat in foods. But extra calories your body doesn't use, such as those from sugar and alcohol, are also transformed into triglycerides. That's why a healthy diet that limits sugar and refined carbohydrates like white bread and white rice, can help to lower triglyceride levels. Minimizing alcohol also helps, as does exercising and maintaining a healthy weight. While it's clear that high LDL or bad cholesterol increases the risk of a heart attack, there's increasing evidence that triglycerides are important too, even if your LDL is under control. Your triglyceride level falls into the high range, which is defined as 200 to 499. And a value of 500 or higher is considered very high. A value of 500 or higher should be treated with medications to prevent inflammation of the pancreas called pancreatitis. Anyone with a triglyceride level of 150 to 499 should be checked and treated for any underlying health problem which might be to blame, including type 2 diabetes, obesity, low thyroid function or hypothyroidism, liver or kidney disease. But if your triglycerides remain high after addressing these issues and making lifestyle changes, medication may be a good idea. Dr. Bott goes on to say that niacin can lower triglycerides, but the high doses required often cause unpleasant side effects, including flushing and stomach upset. Drugs known as fibrates can drop levels by as much as 50%, but neither drug lowers the risk of heart attacks or strokes when added to a statin. But a drug made from highly purified form of EPA, an omega-3 fatty acid found in fish, called icosapent ethyl can. Icosapent ethyl lowers triglycerides, and when taken with a statin, lowers the risk of heart attack, stroke, and death from cardiac causes by 26% in people with either diabetes or cardiovascular disease. Marketed under the name Vascepa, icosapent ethyl recently became available as a generic in the United States. That name is Vascepa. Note that this prescription-only drug is very different from the over-the-counter fish oil supplements found in stores and online. Those non-prescription products also contain EPA, but often in combination with DHA, and the amounts are far lower than in the prescription formulation. Fish oil supplements also aren't regulated for purity or quality control. And now we're going to continue with the Harvard Heart Letter of September, and we're going to look at research we're watching. The first little segment is long periods of sitting will increase the risk of stroke. Sitting too much can boost your risk of a stroke, but adding more movement, even low effort activity like doing household chores, may help to lower that risk, according to a study in the June 1, 2022 issue of JAMA Network Open. The study involved 7,607 adults who wore a hip-mounted accelerometer, which is a device that records how fast you move, for a week. Their average age was 63. During a follow-up period averaging 7.4 years, 246 of the participants experienced a stroke. People who sat for 13 or more hours a day during the initial week of motion tracking were 44% more likely to have a stroke, compared with those who spent less than 11 hours per day sitting still. In addition, longer bouts of sitting, more than 17 minutes at a time, were linked to a higher risk than shorter bouts, less than 8 minutes. Not surprisingly, people who did moderate to vigorous physical activity for at least 25 minutes a day had a 43% lower risk of stroke. But doing light intensity physical activity like vacuuming or doing the dishes for 4 to 5 hours daily lowered stroke risk by 26% compared with doing less than 3 hours per day. The next small section is, could anger and depression raise the risk of AFib? Psychological issues like anger, anxiety, depression, and work stress may be associated with greater risk of developing the heart rhythm disorder known as atrial fibrillation, according to a review article published September 1, 2022, in the International Journal of Cardiology. Researchers examined 13 studies that involved a total of more than 5.3 million participants. They found that the two most common emotional disorders, depression and anxiety, were associated with a 25% and 10% higher risk of atrial fib, respectively. Significant work stress was linked to an 18% greater risk of AFib, and anger to a 15% greater risk. People with depression and anxiety tend to have higher blood levels of stress hormones and substances known as inflammatory biomarkers. Both may contribute to alterations in the heart's electrical activity and structure, which could contribute to atrial fibrillation, according to the study authors. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.